www.mediafree.tvpodcastnetwork.
God, that old boy's got 7 bullets in him. Overkill.
A Deadly Women episode commits some overkill of its own in the voiceover department, and a deciding woman takes on America's most notorious lady serial killer. We're heading to the Sunshine State for The Blotter Presents, episode 14. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents. This week, we're looking at Eileen Wuornos through the lens of two TV properties with the help of a current Floridian, You Glow Girls, Chris Hough. Hello, Chris.
Hey, Sarah.
So before we begin, I have a little bit of pod business. We are off next week because my husband, episode 7's Dan Patrick Brady and star of Unsolved Mysteries, not really, and I are going to celebrate our anniversary / America's birthday. So we will not be here, but we'll be back the week after, the second week of July, to talk about the History Channel's H.H. Holmes property. So you can look forward to that. Today, we are digging into TV's various treatments of Eileen Wuornos, who this has gone off the boil somewhat since she was executed almost 15 years ago now. But TV was very, very much into her. So we're going to start with an episode of Deadly Women, Predators, in our all cold case episode on Eileen Wuornos. Chris, how familiar were you with Eileen and her crimes before you started researching and watching this stuff for today's episode?
A little bit. I had seen Monster like everyone else had with Charlize Theron. Winning the Oscar for basically becoming unattractive, I think, was what the Oscar was for. Like, ooh, pretty women turn ugly.
Yeah.
That's how much they'll commit it. Themselves to the role.
Probably. So you hadn't really watched any of the like Nick Broomfield documentaries and stuff like that with actual.
No, I had not.
Eileen.
No, I had not.
Okay.
No.
So I thought that we would start with this Deadly Women episode just because I thought it would give a sort of a good overview. Of the various cases and what she was like. Mm-hmm. It also gave a pretty good overview of how a lot of times detectives involved in these cases aren't so good at talking in English, as we're going to hear in clip two.
These are very atrocious murders.
As opposed to partly atrocious murders.
Yes.
Is an atrocity like being unique or pregnant, like either it, it's an atrocity or it's not. Yeah.
Like the Holocaust was very atrocious as opposed to like Stalin's purges.
Yeah. Okay. Just sort of like a little atrocious. Sure. Yeah. but they also talk a little bit about what sort of set her apart in terms of being a female serial killer with a like more typically male style. You called for our next clip. Do you want to talk a little bit about what struck you about that?
Oh, well, it's the comment and the tone of the comment that just kind of struck me as really, really odd. So let's hear it and then I'll kind of explain what I was thinking about.
Female predatory killers are very rare.
She becomes known as the monster for a reason.
You actually go out and kill strangers. And I think that it's enormously frightening to men. The idea of being with a woman who suddenly can do that is quite frightening.
I just, it
oh,
kills
word?
Me. Yeah, there you go. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Okay. Just the gender politics here are just like, what is this world coming to that a man can't go out and get a cheap highway blowjob and not fear for his life?
Seriously.
It must have been very frightening for them to solicit prostitutes and think everything would be not be okay. Like, because women don't have to fear for their lives at all when, you know, they're in these situations.
Yeah. And she didn't have to fear for her life starting when she was like 11.
Exactly. Her,
well, we'll get into that. But yeah, like living the life that she led was A, not really a choice so much, mm-hmm. and B, extremely high risk with the victimology.
Exactly.
I mean, I think that a point that they didn't make in this property, and they didn't really make in the next one we'll be talking about, Overkill, the Eileen Wuornos story starring Jean Smart, mm-hmm. is that I think you do have some instances of female serial killers, but the means, the MO is much different, that you would tend to see like more poisoning or mm-hmm. setups as accidental deaths, remoter types of killings, and not this sort of, you know, putting herself in an extremely dangerous situation in order to turn its tables on the victim.
Yeah. Yeah, that's so, how I was going to make a point with the next film is this notion that, you know, female serial killing is really rare, and we've kind of come to understand that it's not. We just had to readjust the way we think about it to
exactly.
really understand that.
And then that I think you also see it, you see some Munchausen's and Angel of Death type serial killers who are women. And who, like, women who have had horrible luck, quote unquote, with numerous babies dying of SIDS, like, after the third one, you wonder if this isn't a pathology.
Yeah, I think you've worked it out by that point.
Here's a guy working it out in the reenactments. it's rather notable. Well, all right, let's just hear it, because okay. if we're meant to sympathize with these guys at all, and I think at least in this case we are, snickering is probably not the reaction that they wanted from clip four.
Run from me, please, lady, just let me go. Oh, just let me go, lady.
I regret that I did not pull a Jerry Lewis sound cue. Lady!
It's like he came in for voiceover work on the wrong day, and they're like, we'll just go with that one.
I know. Well, actually, you're selling, clown services for children's parties, but we're down a man. Would you mind stepping over to this other set? Oh, God, this poor man. And it's just like, shut up. Like, your acting is terrible. Oh, dear.
Yeah, it's the last day. We're out of money. Let's just go with that guy.
I know. Yikes.
I got a similar thing with the next clip. This sort of, you know, you're not pulling in top talent when you're doing this stuff. So sometimes it gets a little dicey.
Yeah. The next clip is sort of describing this period during which Eileen was like living outdoors. She had a little setup sort of like in the woods. And then I guess kids, like, this was a very weird thing because, and you could sort of see this, we'll have a, we'll be tweeting this from our Twitter account at Blutter Presents, but the way it's supposed to be a flashback.
Yeah.
But then they kind of dressed all the extras in this, like, remember the scene in Goodfellas where he goes across the street and all of the like preppy assholes are sitting around fixing someone's car. It's this very like 60s Letterman jacket look that everyone's in.
And the thing she's wearing, I'm not sure. It's like something from the Brady Bunch, but not.
She's not that, like, you're not flashing back that far. It's like 1987.
Yeah.
Anyway, but let's hear the clip and then you can discuss.
A young Eileen uses what she knows. She sells her body to survive.
That's when the neighborhood there started taunting her. You know, saying, well, you're nothing but a hoe and stuff like that.
Shut up!
She went off on everyone, you know, and they went off right back at her.
Dawn Botkins was there in the early years. She was one of Eileen's few friends.
She just wanted to be part of everything with everyone, just sit and drink and smoke.
Wake up!
And be happy and listen to the music. They just would never give her a chance, and I just don't know why.
The monster is shunned and ridiculed. The more she's hurt, the more she strikes back.
The monster is shunned and ridiculed? It really was starting to go in this, like, Victor Hugo direction.
Mm-hmm.
Because the friend, we'll hear another quote from the friend shortly, but the friend has this, like, there's a sadness to the way that she talks about, like, the inevitability of Eileen's life and crimes. Mm-hmm. And gives it some dimension. And then the voiceover and the reenactment that you're seeing kind of pulls you right back out of that to it just being this, like, not a joke, but just kind of this, like, trashy, you know, true crime headline that it's just, I don't know. It's a shame. Like, this property had the opportunity to kind of give you a good overview of what set Eileen Wuornos apart from most deadly mm-hmm. women that they cover. And it was almost there. And then the reenactment ruined it.
Yeah. But I found that in both things and both properties and some of the other stuff I looked at and getting ready for this, they can never really settle on how they want to portray her. They want to go sympathetic. They want to sort of set it up as, you know, the life she had led her to this and, you know, the timing of it was very, very quick and there were some triggers there and this was not necessarily inevitable, but you also need the monster. Like, that the monster was always there just waiting to come out, and that you shouldn't feel any sympathy for what's going on with Eileen. And I you get that there, I think, with that. Also, the just the shut up thing.
Shut up.
Yeah, exactly.
Go Toros. I mean, well, the thing that's interesting, too, and I don't know if you want to spend any more time with this case. It's fine if you don't, but you can find the Nick Broomfield takes on mm-hmm. her online, and even watching just kind of 10 minutes of her in front of the camera, Eileen can't decide how to be from minute to minute. That she's ill. She has borderline personality disorder. So that's a hallmark of that sort of like shifting adjustment to the world constantly and to things that the rest of us kind of don't see because we're better at keeping a composite self together, yes. I guess. I was just an English major. I don't know if I'm using the right terminology here. But I feel for filmmakers, even of trash like Deadly Women, that mm-hmm. it's like, I mean, she's really complicated, but on the other hand, it's pretty simple. Like, she was an antisocial personality and borderline. And from minute to minute, watching the actual person, you're going to get the self-pitying rage. You're going to get the desperation to please and flirt and not be left alone. Mm-hmm. You're going to get the just fear and that then turns into rage. Like, it just keeps going on like that. So I'm sympathetic to the whatever producers of Deadly Women's plight. Like, not only were these the actors they had to work with, but even a good actor that is willing to ugly up, like I'm sure Theron got the Oscar for gaining a bunch of weight and having a couple teeth blacked out. I'm sure you're mm-hmm. right. But she was actually really good. She kind of mastered that.
She was.
Fluid desperation. So she deserved it. If she got it for the wrong reasons, at least she like had the right ones on point.
Yeah. And it's interesting. I play in a band. I play in biker bars. And I see and meet these people all the time. Not ones that go to the length that she did. But I mean, I very well could end up over the bar she got arrested at.
Right.
So I see kind of people in those circumstances all the time, and I'm talking to them all the time. And I was watching these things going, yep, I know this person to a certain extent. Just this sort of desperation, like constantly hoping that things are going to get better, but always making these horrible choices. Some that you can't control, others that you can, that are just going to keep you right where you're at. So maybe I was feeling, I was coming down on the sympathetic side with her a lot more probably than most people would.
Yeah, so was I. It didn't seem like she had any other, like, even if she saw other choices, mm-hmm. they were probably almost as bad as what she was looking at. Like, you wonder if she didn't, like, she did some time in jail, and you wonder if that wasn't, yeah, like, maybe better for her. But then she was also very paranoid and self-pitying about that experience.
Yes.
Probably not wrongly. I don't disbelieve that she was assaulted in jail either. But you just wonder, like, how else was it ever going to turn out?
Yeah. And the thing that I really, if there's any aspect of it that I really latched onto, is that need to take care of somebody.
Yeah.
People who, like, particularly when they've had children taken away, or very early in life had children and somehow that got messed up. Later in life, they have lots of pets and they have lots of friends that they kind of adopt as someone that they have to look after. So that really hit home when I, the whole Tyra relationship.
Yeah. And also that sense that if she could just take care of this person, that she could, yeah, also control this person's behavior and keep her from leaving. And that in the end, in order to make this sort of, I mean, I guess it's a vainglorious gesture, mm-hmm, but she was, Tyra was like, well, they're going to put me in jail. So Eileen confesses finally. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think was probably like relieved to have it be over. Maybe I'm projecting, like, I just have mood disorders, not a personality disorder. So maybe I'm projecting a slightly more logical take on it, but it's sort of like, in order for Tyra to commit the ultimate abandonment of Eileen, mm-hmm, she made this grand gesture for Tyra that was supposed to keep her close and prove that she loved her. I mean, but this person had no, Eileen Wuornos had absolutely nothing to imprint on that was correct or nurturing ever, not even a beach ball. And you kind of hear, yeah, that in our last clip in this section.
With few other friends, Eileen becomes an obsessive correspondent with childhood friend Don Botkins.
She wrote every day for 11 years, and sometimes I got 11 letters in one day. People are starting to see there was quite a human being there that nobody helped out. State didn't help out. The neighbors didn't help out. Nobody helped out.
Sigh. It's just so sad. Like, I love Dawn Botkin's take on it, that she's just like, she seems very accepting. Like, she, mm-hmm, she's still a little, like, annoyed at how she's like, 11 in one day, really, girl? Yeah. But it's like, that's family for you. It's her tone, which I like that about her, that she's like, look, this is who she was. This is what she was like.
Yeah, so this sort of acceptance of, like, I don't care what anyone else says. I knew this person, and, there was this good side to her that no one else really wanted to see or take care of.
Yeah, and there was this extremely needy side that tells you literally everything that you need to know about her and how all of this must have come to pass. I mean, mm-hmm, maybe she was born bad. I don't know, but I don't think so.
No, I think there were
chances for this to have not gone horribly awry. And
yeah, well, the thing I liked about that clip as well, and it also, it's something that I don't know if it's just me, it might be just in crime documentaries where all of a sudden this thing is going on and I don't know how it happened. Like, how did she get back in touch with her childhood friend? Like, who wrote who first? And how did this become this central relationship? It was just like, well, Tyra's gone, and now here's this other person, and she's writing with her all the time. I'm like, wait, how did that happen?
Someone, yeah, or like, this is the only person who would admit to having corresponded mm-hmm. with. Yeah.
Yeah. I wonder, it just popped in my head, if there's like this, you know, the whole thing with women who get attached to serial killers in jail, get married. I wonder if there was a reverse side to that, if that ever happened. I don't know. With Eileen or anyone else for that matter. There's guys out there going, ooh, I want a serial killer.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, well, that's a whole, geez. I should do a whole episode on those.
Like yeah.
the wives of serial killers.
Yes.
All right, listeners, if you know of any relevant TV properties so that we can try sort of, in theory, to stay on topic around here, let us know. Again, the Twitter is at Blotter Presents. All right, moving on, if you're ready, to our second cold case. All right.
I'm ready.
I had had some form of coverage for this property on my list of things to try to do for our website at previously.tv for like 2 years. I forget who told me that in 1992, Jean Smart of Designing Women and also season 2 of Fargo starred in Overkill, the Eileen Wuornos story. It's really the story of a certain extremely intense alto saxophone. They do manage to get some Eileen Wuornos material in there. Park, I always want to say Park Overstreet. That's not her name. Park Overall?
Yeah, I want to say Lacey Underalls from Caddyshack every time I hear her.
No, Knox Overstreet. It's she's the one that I always get confused with Perry Gilpin from Frasier, but no, it's Park Overall from Empty Nest, I believe. Yes. And we'll get into the casting of Ty's sister in a couple of minutes, but I expected this movie to be complete garbage time, so I was pleasantly surprised, but I had serious concerns about the casting of Jean Smart because I just thought she was physically too attractive and like healthy. She didn't have that gristly living outdoors look that mm-hmm. Wuornos always had. Were you like, this is never going to work going into it?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I was dubious that this was going to get pulled off. And for that reason, because I'm like, Jean Smart, she's really classy. Oh, she was also in Legion, by the way, the most recent Marvel property.
All right.
Yes. Being very good in that. And particularly after, you know, seeing her on Designing Women, because, you know, Allison makes me watch it all the time. I don't know how she's going to do this, but I thought she did a good job. I think she pulled it off.
I thought she did a great job. Given what we were talking about in the last segment about how difficult this woman as a character is to pin down, because she's a whole mm-hmm. bunch of characters and you're getting like all of them sometimes in the space of 30 seconds. I thought she did a really good job. She has a sort of like very depressed flatline confession scene at the end that I thought was perfectly played. I bought her like desperate freakouts when she felt that she was being abandoned.
Mm-hmm.
I bought her anger and sort of like combative trying to flirt with guys. Like mm-hmm. I bought it. It took a while to get used to her. And especially when she's like putting on her working makeup, I was like, well, I've seen booking photos of the real thing and that's not close.
No,
I mean, it's not good, but it's not close.
No.
But when Ty's sister comes to visit in Overkill, mm-hmm. here's where it gets interesting. First of all, the sister is played by the same actress who played Toby, the incoming newspaper editor of the Beverly Blaze. A lot of parents read it on Beverly Hills 90210 in the Donna Martin Graduates episode. Wow. I was like, where do I know that bitchy voice from?
The depths it's of your knowledge are, wow.
Yeah, I, okay. Well, and depths they are. Believe it. But in this scene, the writing does a really good job sort of communicating why these two people, Ty and Lee, are together, but also points up a major, not discrepancy. I'm not sure what the right word is.
This scene exists for one reason and one reason only.
Yeah, and it should exist for another reason that they avoid, like it's covered in poo. So let's listen to the clip, and then I'll talk about this issue.
Are you happy, Ty?
Sure. Yeah, I suppose. What do you mean?
I don't know. Lee's okay. It's just sometimes I kind of have a hard time figuring out why she's your friend. I mean, she's... Look how she makes her money. Doesn't that bother you?
Sure it does. But I can't make her change. I tried and I can't. So I try not to think about it. Look, it's just what she does. It's not who she is. Deep down, Lee's a good person.
I'm sorry, Ty. I just don't get it.
Lee's an older sister to me like I am to you. We take care of each other. And for her, I'm the only family she's got. There isn't anybody else. At least not worth knowing. She needs me.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Here's my issue. This movie, there is like this giant hole in the floor of this movie.
Mm-hmm.
That is the fact that they were gay.
Oh, yeah. That's the whole scene is like, let's find five different ways of saying that they're not gay.
Like, I just don't understand why she's your friend. I'm like, I don't understand that either, because they are dating. They live together. They scissor. They are gay.
Yeah, well, it's the pre-Will and Grace TV landscape, you know.
But was that pre? Like, I guess it was. I mean, I wasn't surprised by this. It started to be amusing to me how... like the lengths they were going to just be like, it's a Boston marriage and that implies nothing. They live in Boston. What? Like, guys, come on.
Yeah. I mean, this was a lot closer to the mid-80s AIDS crisis kind of social landscape than today. So I was not surprised. And, you know, just the division between discussing violence and sex, it's like, you know, the church ladies out in Iowa, when they're watching this on Sunday night, they're okay with mass murder, but oh my God, implies someone that is gay and that, you know, their 10-year-old niece wanders through the room when you're discussing it and the network's being boycotted all of a sudden.
Yeah, true. I mean, it's just interesting because I think this movie is quite progressive about finding Eileen Wuornos a sympathetic figure and like seeing why.
In that regard, I think so.
Became the monster, but then it was like, well, we can do that.
Mm-hmm.
Or she can be gay, but not both.
Well, and that's, I think those things actually kind of go hand in hand, because something that's sort of underneath the need to create sympathy for her, I think, is this gender dynamic that women serial killers can't have the same psychopathy, if that's the right word, as male serial killers. Like this need for violence and kind of that scariness of male serial killers, women can't have it. Even if we're in a world where we can now label women serial killers, there has to be an explanation that does not completely abandon their womanness. So,
right.
That kind of goes hand in hand.
So did you want to introduce our next clip? Because this sort of goes into the their need to sort of keep explaining.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. So
how she came
we have a voiceover. Basically, this is one of the murders. The show never actually explicitly that I remember shows her. Oh yeah, once. Most of the time, though, it's a voiceover. You get this voiceover of the killing taking place, and then you see the body later. So this is one of those instances.
Told you before, I don't do that.
Just so you know, darling, I don't take orders from sluts.
I said step away from the car. Slow.
I'm paying for the ride, baby, not you.
What were you gonna do with this, cowboy?
Oh, please.
Huh?
Please,
what were
don't.
You gonna do with
please.
This?
No, don't.
Well.
So. Yeah, well, I picked that one basically because in the way it kind of distracts from Jean Smart, in that you have someone who's really doing a good job keeping this thing afloat, and they're not giving her a lot to work with sometimes.
Yeah, it's true.
And it's kind of almost funny. You know, it's almost humorous hearing that guy talk, which pulled me out of it a little bit as well.
Yeah, that was not a great, but I think it was also smart to do it just as a, just as voice acting in a lot of these cases, because I, you know, she maintained that she, I think, was always acting in self-defense. And I suspect if all of this had happened 10 or 20 years after it did, that she might have had a more, she might have had a better chance at defending herself based on like using a PTSD defense, that even if there was no immediate threat, and even if she had quote unquote put herself in this situation, I think there would definitely be an argument that having been and raped by her grandfather and his friends and impregnated by one of them when she was a tween, that this was being carried forward and it was extremely traumatic. So
yeah, I think we've come a long way in that regard. In
I mean, who knows? It's Florida. They like to hang people.
Yeah. We
like there's a PTSD defense, and then there's doing it in like Texas where, you know,
When one of the worst serial killers of all time, Ted Bundy, is like, where can I go that I'm going to get executed if I go and try? He's like, ah, Florida. I'm going to Florida.
That's the stuff. Yeah, there are a couple of acting bum notes in here. It's more or less a good cast. A lot of like TV movie, hey, it's that guy's. When the cops spend a lot of time trying to like work through their issues surrounding assigning these crimes to a lady. Yeah. And in the next scene, the guy, the captain is like, I think we have a woman killer on our hands. And the rhubarbing and peas and carrotsing of the rest of the like under five cops is hilarious in clip 9.
What are you suggesting, Captain?
I'm suggesting that we're looking for a serial killer.
What?
That's insane.
All right, second from the right guy. You're excused.
Yeah. Well, I love the cops in general. It's like every single one of them was playing like the angry black supervisor from 48 Hours. Because they're just yelling at each other all the time. Like, I would hate to be a cop. I have a friend who's a cop. I should ask him about this. Like, do you guys just yell at each other all the time? Like, I'll have a Subway 6-inch for lunch, you know?
And then there are a few scenes where they're like apologizing to each other and like squashing it and being bros. And it's like, really? Like, I know you had exactly, you know, you had the 2 hours to fill out, but do I need to, I don't care about your working relationship. How'd you get her?
Yeah. Yeah, they
but
were just.
Yeah, this, it does seem like there are repeated scenes where someone's like, I'm telling you, I think it's a woman. And the other one's like, nah.
Can't be. That's impossible.
But that's not for ladies. Clip 10 is a good example of that. Let's have a listen.
Now, what kind of person could get him out in the woods? And it occurred to me, maybe we're looking for a woman.
A woman?
I know it sounds strange, but all these men, some of them naked, a condom, chambers seen hanging around a motel truck stop known for prostitution.
But Dan, a woman? When women kill, they kill people they know. They murder their husbands, they murder their lovers, they murder their husbands' lovers. But you never, ever hear of women killing strangers. That's what serial killers do. It's stranger on stranger.
I guess you're right. Just thought I'd mention it.
All right, first of all, what is with the one guy's accent? They kill the husbands. They kill the lovers. They kill the husbands' lovers. Oh, do they?
I wish I was here. No, she would be able to tell you exactly what accent is. Like, oh, that's East Northern Tennessee accent. She knows every Southern accent. I don't know how, but she does.
All right. I'm going to put in a bid for rural Georgia. That's my failing. And or Southern Virginia. And listeners, hit us in the forums at previously.tv. Correct me. We're both from Jersey. We don't know anything.
We do not.
But yeah, that's one of like four scenes where the cops are like, well, all the evidence points to it being this. Well, it can't be that. Because
yeah, at one point they're like, and we found a condom. And they're like, no, that doesn't tell us anything.
Like, yeah. And a picture of a lady signed by the lady committing the crime. Can't be. Yeah. It's a setup. Okay.
Yes. And her name in lipstick on the door of the car. I don't know.
I know.
Well, Well, I like the other thing about that one is it's like this really outdated version of what a serial killer is. I think we've, in the past 20 or 30 years or so, really have rethought serial killing is and mass killing for obvious reasons, because it seems to happen so much more often now. But in doing so, it brings women back into the picture. I don't think, you know, when this was made, you would have had a bunch of documentaries about great female serial killers of history. Because we understood it as a male thing in this very specific context, very violent context. And then now, you know, you go to websites and you find, oh, serial killers, female serial killers of history. Britain, for example, seems to have a disproportionately large number
right.
of female serial killers. I don't know. It's cold all the time or something. I don't know why.
The food. Just kidding. Don't ask. Yeah.
I like that as a moment of history. It's like, no, there are no such thing as female serial killers.
And it's, yeah, there's also, and you see this actually, speaking of Bundy, in The Deliberate Stranger, which like took a while to be solved because the notion of a serial killer, like as separate from a like spree killing, which mm-hmm. Ted Bundy also did. That's what he did in Florida. But you forget that, first of all, the cops didn't necessarily, like, there was no internet. They weren't always willing to take help from the FBI that had a slightly more advanced mm-hmm. notion of these things and didn't suffer from, like, historical linkage blindness or whatever you call yes. it. But then you also forget that at the same time as that, there's still no internet. And people get a lot of their information on these stories from these TV movies. So there is a lot of explaining, like, here's why we're not looking at this. Here's why nobody, you know, here's what we would normally do for the folks in Peoria who have not read an entire shelf of shit about Ted Bundy, like this guy. And like, we know, like, how come? And then on top of that, Bundy was a master. He's like escaping from jail and shit. So this movie, I thought, given, and I know I just made fun of it, but it's actually pretty well paced, given that you're still in an era of TV movie history where they are having to explain like basic processy stuff to the folks in the cheap seats. So
yeah, I liked it more than I thought I would. Although at the same time, I was like, yeah, this is what we got, you know, pre expansive cable lineup streaming golden age of TV stuff, where it's like, you can put this on, you know, in a feature spot in prime time and have people go, we're going to watch this. Like, she was great. Like I said, I thought she was great. Park overall was not bad.
It's always tough to separate her performance from her voice. I thought she was fine. And given that she was forced to like, drive this very narrow fairway in terms of really selling, she has this one scene where she has to sell it on the phone to
get her to admit.
And she's like, she's just destroyed by doing it. And afterwards she's sobbing and bereft. And given that she has to sell all this, it's like, well, we're just friends. And occasionally her hands brush against each other. I thought it was quite a good performance. Her voice is not for everyone. She was the Joey Lauren Adams of her day, I guess.
I was thinking that scene exactly as well. The moment where I was like, yeah, she did a really good job. This is well done.
And they also did a good job, I thought, with our last clip, which is when one of the lead detectives, I forget this actor's name, but he's basically the poor man's William Fichtner. I think he used to be a stunt guy. He's no longer with us, this guy, but he's like that. Okay. He's got that perfect like Nordic cop face. He was in a bunch of these. And there's always that scene where like the detective can't crack this case. He promised his wife he'd quit smoking, whatever. She finds him on the porch and she's like, honey, what is it? Like, you married a cop. The fuck do you think it is? He's freaking out about a case. Doy. But like, they actually did a good job with it in this movie and didn't sort of overplay the like committed cop taken over by the, and he does an excellent job laying out for the audience why Eileen is really this tragic figure in our last clip, clip 11.
I ran a background check on Lee Warnos today.
And?
Her father was a child molester who hung himself in prison. There's a pretty strong indication that she was raped by both her grandfather and her brother.
Oh, my God.
She had an illegitimate child of 13 that was put up for adoption. She's been on the streets hooking ever since.
How do you make a life from that?
I don't know. Maybe you don't. But how do you decide to take people out in the woods and kill them?
Well, yeah. I mean, here we are again at the sort of central puzzle of Eileen Warnos.
Yeah. And
how could this have been stopped? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was, it took me a while and I realized he was in the Bruce Willis film, The Fifth Element.
Oh, yeah.
He was the general, the major, or the general, whoever, whatever role he played. It was, yeah, I was like, oh, that guy, okay. But yeah, it is this, and I'm starting to fall down on the need to see her sympathetically because of the larger reason and implications that would come along with the existence of female serial killers and the challenges that presents the, you know, gender dynamics.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. You know, I'm watching a show right now. It's a lot about gender, so it's very much in the front of my mind right now. But yeah, this need to see women killers in a sympathetic light because it helps reinforce what we want to believe about why women kill.
True. But I think it's also on the sort of more positive side of the ledger. I think that whether they were sort of aware of it or not, and they didn't call it this, that this cycle of abuse being passed down through families via incarceration, abandonment, children who were abused, not getting any resources to deal with it and like kicking that shit downhill, that's also sort of an institutional tragedy. I think we're better equipped to identify and name that now, but I'm not sure we're any better at addressing it or getting people the help they need. But at least this movie sort of tried not to take her off the hook. Exactly. And I agree that the sort of gendering of certain kinds of serial killing is not problematic. They're serial killers. That's problematic for the people killed. But at least it tried to put her in a context where she just, like, there was no changing lanes for her.
Yeah. And maybe the timing of it, you know, works in that regard too. Because, you know, this happened within less than a year. I think it was 7 months.
Yeah.
Where she did all the killings. So this was not long term. This wasn't, you know, 4 or 5 or a decade, like Green River Killer stuff. Something triggered it. Something changed and she kind of went into this space and did these 7 killings, I think, in 6 or 7 months.
Yeah.
So that helps.
That's right.
I think in seeing it sympathetically.
Yeah, true. That she was just decompensating from whatever, from whatever trigger existed. Well, I never thought that I would recommend this movie, and I'm not sure I'm going to recommend this movie, but given, and again, like I said, it's a low bar, but given what we were expecting, it actually, for the time it was made, and given what we were expecting, I thought it did a lot of things well. Give it like a B minus, And it's the only thing of its kind. Like, until Monster was made, this was it.
Yeah.
Scripted wise. So
we didn't mention this, but I just want to mention real quick the design of the flashback scenes. Like, they were all like one color. Like, every time she had a flashback, it was like everything's in yellow or everything's in his. Very Twin Peaks. I don't know. Maybe Twin Peaks. That was the same time. Maybe those are some sort of influence.
Oh, yeah. But, I guess it was.
Kind of weird. Like, how they set those up. Kind of. That's another thing that sort of pulled me out of, okay, we're getting this nice, gritty, realistic portrayal, and then this very stylized flashback setup that didn't quite work as well as they probably wanted it to.
Well, but it worked better than we thought.
Yes.
Because after, I mean, I watched The Deadly Women first, and even though that was only like a 15-minute segment of a longer episode, I was like, geez, like, if this is as bad, if Overkill is as bad, I'm not sure I can do it.
Yeah.
I'm not sure Although I can the, make it.
Well, they actually, they did the reenactment of Ty in the documentary, actually had a woman who looked very much like Ty did in real life.
Yeah.
In that documentary, they really didn't hide or try to alter the reality of the situation in the way they did.
Yeah, and in Monster, too, Ty was, you know, very, very femme. Very
yes,
femme.
Yes, Christina Ricci, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think in real life, not as much.
No, I saw much.
I mean, Deadly Women, of course, may have been, again, as with the victim reenactment. They may have been limited in their, you know, selection, but yeah, that was a plus. Mm. All right. Well, that concludes this episode of Eileen Wuornos Properties. But before we leave you, Chris, do you have anything to plug for us? Where can listeners find you?
I got two things to plug. I got the Excellent. You Glow Girl podcast, which Allison, my wife, and I are doing for the Netflix show Glow, in which we talk all about wrestling and women in wrestling and gender politics and all sorts of wonderful 80s fashion things.
Southern accents.
Mm-hmm. Southern accents, desperation, the nastiness of Hollywood in the 1980s. We cover a lot of ground. And that's going on right now. We have episode 2 is out. I think episode 3 is coming soon in the next couple of days. So,
should be out by the time you're listening to this podcast. And you can find that and all of our other podcasts at previously.tv/podcasts.
Excellent. And I also want to recommend a crime doc that I watched recently on Netflix as well. The 7-5. Do you know about this one, Sarah?
I heard of it, but refresh my memory. Someone this recommended is, it.
It's a documentary. Yeah, it's a documentary from 2014. It's about the 75th precinct of the New York Police Department, New York City Police Department. And how about two cops, a guy named Michael Dowd and Ken Urell in the late 80s, early 90s, during the crack epidemic that was sweeping New York City, basically went from being cops on the take to working for a drug lord in the city. And it kind of explores how that process happened, how they got caught, and the implications and results of this exposure of extreme corruption in the police force in the 90s. It's like the Serpico of the 1990s for the New York City Police Department.
Well, that may pair well with Snowfall, which is the story of crack in LA in the 80s, and that's coming on Fox or FX. Now I can't remember. I think it's FX, and that's that's next week, July 5th, I think.
Mm-hmm.
That premieres. All right, folks. That's The Blotter Presents for this week. We're off next week, like I said, but next time we'll be visited by Toby Ball, and we'll be discussing H.H. Holmes, the murder hotel guy from Chicago and Devil in the White City, in History Channel's limited series American Ripper. Hit us up on the tip line on our forums at previously.tv. Again, we're on Twitter at Blotter Presents. My guest Chris Huff is on Twitter at Meat of Cheese. And we'll talk to you next time.
This has been a production of the Previously.tv Podcast Network.